What's that sound? It's a cordless drill. In fact, it's one of the thousands of cordless and electric drills purchased each year. But you know what? Hardly anyone who invested in one of those drills really wanted the product, the drill. That's right. What they really wanted was the hole, the benefit. And that's our topic, selling the benefits, not just the product. As you know, you don't sell just products. You sell what your product does. Now, just visualize a quarter-inch hole. That's what you want. You only need the drill so you can get the hole. And selling benefits like this is a matter of building powerful units of conviction in the mind of your prospect. Earlier, we discussed why some salespeople aren't believed. Consumers have had negative experiences, and they've been negatively conditioned. But this conditioning can be overcome, just like my negative conditioning was overcome by the positive experience I had with Richards Leasing. Ever since then, I've had a completely different attitude towards car and truck dealers. So the solution to the credibility problem is to build a powerful selling presentation using units of conviction and then deliver thrilling service. The concept of the units of conviction was taught to me by the world-famous sales trainer of over five decades, Mr. Fred Herman. Fred was a master at teaching the principles of selling. As a matter of fact, his ideas and methods and techniques form the basis of most of the sales training courses taught today. These techniques are timeless and certainly still applicable because they're based on principles. You know, earlier in this program, I made the statement that the principles of selling don't change very much. I mean, how could that be? I mean, my gosh, everything is changing and changing so fast. But a principle doesn't change very much. Like the principle of gravity. Many thousands of years ago, ancient man might have dropped his stone axe. 1,000 years ago, a European stone cutter might have dropped his metal chisel and hammer. 50 years ago, a carpenter might have dropped his electric drill. And today, you could drop your cordless drill. All four tools fall because the principle of gravity hasn't changed. But our tools, the specifics, have. As technology keeps advancing, what we sell changes. The features will improve, but remember, you sell benefits. As an example, when Charles Williams Jr. of Somerville, Massachusetts, on April 4, 1877, ran a line 3 miles long between his Boston office and his home in Somerville, it was the first telephone installed in a private home. Now, what did Williams want? To communicate to someone at a location he wasn't at without leaving where he was. That was his benefit. On August 13, 1889, William Gray invented the first coin-operated public phone. So the benefit, still the same, except you didn't have to be at home or at work. You could be at a gas station or a convenience store. On November 18, 1963, touch-tone phones are invented to make the same benefit occur, but even faster than rotary dialing. And in 1983, cellular systems start up, making calls from almost anywhere in major cities possible. For what benefit? To communicate to someone in a location where you aren't without leaving where you are. You see, specifics change. Principles remain basically the same. It's the same in 21st century selling. So keep focusing on principles, because in this message you're going to hear lots of specifics, and they may not apply directly to you and your unique selling situation, but the principles sure do. In my sales training work since 1974, I've added to and refined these basic principles from Fred Herman into a 21st century approach to selling the benefits, not just the features. So for our discussion on this message, a unit of conviction is a statement that has five parts. First, you state a fact or describe a feature of your product. Second, you explain its function. You tell what the fact or the feature does for the product. Third, you explain how that function will benefit the prospect. Fourth, you prove the benefit with some form of evidence. Fifth and finally, you use a question to get verbal acceptance of the benefit. It's like this old story points out so well. It's a roasting hot July day, and a little old lady goes into a store looking for an air conditioning unit to help cool her off. Have you noticed how many stories use little old ladies? Everything from the used car with hardly any miles on it to the little old lady who lived in a shoe. Well, there's a good reason for it. It adds impact. And we all know what little old ladies look like. It's an easy picture in your mind. Okay, so the little old lady in this story finds a salesperson who quickly and efficiently qualifies her as a Class A 7.5-point prospect for a new cooling system for her home. After a powerful and very professional demonstration of his company's air conditioning units, including its high efficiency, the dual compressors for two-stage cooling, its enhanced airflow to provide greater humidity control, the 10-year warranty on the compressors, he closes for time to install this wonderful marvel of air conditioning technology. This sweet little old lady looks at the unit, looks at the salesman, and politely says, "Young man, I have just one question. Will this unit keep a little old lady cool?" And that's what selling the benefits is really all about. What will it do for your customer? Now, that sounds very simple. Well, it is simple, but it's not easy. Just like golf is a simple game. To shoot par golf, all you need to do is land on the green and two shots under par for that hole, then sink the ball in two putts. Then you just do that for each of the 18 holes, and you're shooting par golf. I mean, it's very simple. But as nearly any golfer will tell you, it's not that easy. Well, since your goal in listening to these messages is not to look for an easy way to sell better, but to look for many ways to just plain sell better. And like most good things, that's going to take some time, effort, and energy, and of course, practice. It also requires that you become uncomfortable. Yes, uncomfortable. Uncomfortable with the status quo, because unless you're uncomfortable, you tend not to look for a better way. For example, when your clothes seem to be shrinking and getting too tight on you, you begin to realize that they're not shrinking, you're just getting bigger. This makes you uncomfortable, and when you get uncomfortable enough, you decide, hey, I'm going to lose some weight, or I'm going to go buy some bigger clothes. Either way, your goal is to become more comfortable, and you take some sort of action. So let me start making you uncomfortable about your product. Mentally think of one of the best features or the most important facts about your product. Go ahead, just think of one thing and get it in your mind. Okay, now imagine that I'm your prospect, and you're going to tell me what the best feature or the most important fact is. And my response to you is going to be, so what? Who cares? As a matter of fact, I don't just say it, I'm going to shout it at you. And every prospect you call on this week, when they hear you describe that feature or that fact, they're going to scream at you. So what? Who cares? Would that make you uncomfortable? So what would you do about it? Well, you could just stop making sales calls and stop describing those same features and facts. That might make you comfortable for a while until you run out of money. Or you could make sure that you can answer their so what and who cares with a powerful, believable, and customized benefit. Now let me give you some examples of a fact or feature for some common products. These are all tangible products. And you're very familiar with them. A plastic shopping bag, a pen, and a shirt. Okay? Let's take the plastic shopping bag. It's 4 mils thick. So what? Who cares? The pen has a bright chrome clip on it. So what? Who cares? You know, this shirt has buttons that won't fall off or break. Well, so what and who cares? Now, if you sold shopping bags, pens, and shirts, I'd imagine you wouldn't like me very much for yelling at you, so what, and who cares? But if you get uncomfortable enough, you'll quickly turn those features or fact statements into benefits for the customer. And we're going to do that a little later in the session, but right now, just think, if you're selling a tangible product of any kind, so what, who cares? Now, what about intangibles? Things you might sell that can't be seen, touched, or demonstrated. Here are some specific examples that you're also familiar with. Automobile insurance, computer networking, and financial services. And it's probably safe to assume that you've had some experience with each of these, at least to some degree. So let's start off with automobile insurance. Most states require you have insurance. Now, you might have a company car to use, and in that case, the company insures it for you. But you also might have your own personal car, a truck, an SUV, or a motorcycle. And as you know, insurance of any kind is a totally intangible sale. It's a promise by the insurance company that if something happens that you're insured for, they will pay for it. It's built strictly on trust, and so by law, insurance companies are highly regulated to guarantee you that coverage. So here's what the auto insurance salesperson says to you, their customer. Our office provides service to you for your claims 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So what? Who cares, you say. Next, the computer network service provider. This is a company that sells both hardware, software, and services to businesses who have at least several or sometimes hundreds of computers that need to talk to each other. So the salesperson says to you, we won't leave you until it's done and everything works. And you say, or better yet, you shout, so what? Who cares? Next is a financial services salesperson coming to you to sell you an investment, say in a mutual fund, a stock, or an annuity, or some other vehicle to help you increase your wealth. And they say something like this: we provide you with a monthly performance statement on all your investments, showing you exactly how they have performed. So what? Who cares, you say? Well, regardless of the product you're selling, tangible or intangible, this is where you need to be prepared with those units of conviction based on benefits. Now, sometimes as you begin structuring your own benefits for your own products, you'll see that there are multiple benefits. There's a product benefit. That's what the feature does to make the product unique. Then there's a customer benefit. That's what the decision maker gets when the product is used. And then there's also a user benefit, because in many cases, the customer you're selling to is the decision maker, but not the user. In pharmaceutical sales, when sales representatives call on physicians, hospitals, and caregivers, in most cases, the products they're buying aren't used by any of them. They're prescribed for their patients. So there needs to be a physician benefit as well as a patient benefit. Same for a professional buyer who's a purchasing agent for a big company. Most likely, they don't actually use the products they're buying. But you need to give them a benefit for doing business with you. Remember, WIIFM, what's in it for me? Now I'm going to jump around a bit on those examples and illustrate how you can build a unit of conviction based on WIIFM for each of them. First, the plastic shopping bags for trade shows, conventions, exhibits, or fairs. You know the kind given away free as you wander around those events, and they have the manufacturer or the supplier's name and advertising on them. One of my seminar clients sells millions of these plastic bags to major corporations. So here's the feature. It's 4 mils thick. The function, the plastic bags are extra strong. So what? Who cares? Well, now let's jump right into three types of benefits. The first benefit is the benefit to the product. The bags won't break. The second benefit is the customer benefit. Now, here's where you need to differentiate. The customer is most likely a purchasing agent, the national sales manager, or maybe somebody in the marketing or sales promotion department in charge of conventions and exhibits. So the customer in this case is the one making the buying decision, not the one who will eventually use the plastic bag. So to your buyer, the benefit statement could be, your plastic giveaway bags will hold up all day, and your attendees who get one will only need one bag for the entire show, yours. Plus, they can reuse it when they get home. But third is the user benefit. Now, the user being the attendee who will be given the bag. So you could say something like this, Mrs. Purchasing Agent, when you give your show attendees your extra strong 4 mil plastic bags, they can easily put all of your promotional materials and giveaways in it and get back to their home or office without losing anything. Now, next, you got to prove it. Hey, show me some evidence of how strong those bags really are. This is how the sales rep I saw making this powerful presentation showed the evidence. He took a bowling ball and put it in one of the ordinary bags, and it broke, one after another, and each time it broke right through, crashed to the floor. Now, of course, he had put a foam pad down on the floor first so it wouldn't damage the floor. Then he handed his extra strong 4 mil plastic bag to the customer and dropped the bowling ball in it. It held perfectly. No tearing, no crash. It was a powerful form of visual evidence, followed by a smile and a nail down. That's one strong bag, isn't it? It sure could hold a lot of your materials, couldn't it? See how specific you need to make your benefits? Okay, now let's go to one of those intangibles. Let's say that computer networking. Now, the product is really a service. Although there were some actual products involved, let me set this next illustration up with a little preliminary background. As I mentioned earlier, sometimes as part of my preparation for my custom seminars, I go out on a few sales calls with a local sales rep, if the company has one in the Phoenix area, so I can think like a customer. In preparation for a seminar for Venture Tech Network, an organization that trains independent, locally owned companies as authorized solutions integrators, I needed to see for myself exactly what a solutions integrating company did. So I spent the day making sales calls with one of them, Doug Baker, a principal in an Arizona-based company, Enterprise Network Technologies, ENT for short. Well, not only did I learn a lot from watching Doug sell, I became so impressed with him that when it came time for our little company to network our computers, we called on Doug to give us a proposal. Judy, as I mentioned, runs the business, and she and the rest of our staff all met with Doug so he could identify our needs. Normally, he told us, we would be too small of a company for the type of installations he did. He really designed only much larger installations. But since he and I hit it off, he'd be willing to help us out. Now, how's that for a sales approach? Well, we said, that's great, but why should we pay you to network our computers, provide us with newer and faster computers, the switch, the server, and all the new software when we can buy all that stuff directly on the Internet? Here's Doug Baker's first statement. Well, sure, you can buy that hardware and software almost anywhere, and you're welcome to do that. What ENT provides you is the expertise to put your network all together, and we don't leave you until it's done. Now, that's the feature of a service. So what's the product benefit? You'll have all the right products for your computers to be able to share information quickly and efficiently. Well, so what, and who cares? Maybe the computers like being hooked up together. But what's the customer benefit to me, Judy, and the staff? By us staying until it's done, we ensure you that all the information you now have stored will be protected, transferred to the new system, and backed up. Plus, our technical support specialist will make sure all aspects of the network are working correctly and that you know how to use all your new software. So prove it. Well, as a matter of fact, here's a letter from a company president we did the exact same thing for, except on a much larger scale. That's evidence. And then he said, Judy, do you like the idea that we're going to take responsibility for the complete network installation and stay with you till the job is done? Well, sure, of course, Judy said. Well, with that, they spent some time going over the details. Doug put together a proposal, and we ended up buying everything from him anyway. Now, what did he sell? The benefit of his expertise, not computers, not software, switches, or network hubs. He sold the benefit. You know, it's interesting, the very next week, a flyer that was stuck in our USA Today newspaper offered this computer system with a large rebate. Matter of fact, several rebates. Now, I have no idea how much that four-color ad insert cost for the USA Today or how many systems they sold as a result of it. But I do know that Doug Baker sells lots of systems without going into a features-only list. Now, sure, he's got to describe the features, but what he's selling is an intangible. Installation, expertise, training, and holding your hand, being there. So how about in your selling? How can you use those units of conviction? First, the fact or feature. Second, explain the function, what that fact or feature does for the product. Third, show or explain how that function will benefit the prospect and the end user. Fourth, then you must prove the benefit, not the feature. Let me say that again. You want to prove with evidence that the benefit is true. And finally, fifth, you want to get their agreement that they accept the benefit. Here, listen to another example. Now, this one might sound so silly at first because it's for a ballpoint pen. However, you're looking at an order of 1,000 gross. That's 144,000 pens. You know, little things do add up. So let's say you're selling these pens with a custom imprint on them, and the purchasing agent can't decide which one to order. The one with a clip on the cap for 6 cents more, or the one without the clip. So you say, the pen you're holding has a retractable tip, a refillable cartridge, and a clip on the cap. So what? The purchasing agent snaps. Well, you just smile and say, you know, as you know, the function of that clip is to attach the pen to your customer's pocket or a notebook, so they won't lose it. Now that's the end user benefit. What's the benefit to your decision maker, the purchasing agent? Well, you could say something like this. By your customer holding on to that pen longer, the more times they will see your company name and your website address on the pen, the more chance they'll have to contact you and order again. See how strong that clip is? And as you put it on a pad and shake the pad wildly, you could say, and it won't come off easily by mistake and get lost. That's a strong clip, isn't it? Now the nail down. And the longer your customer has the pen, the more times they will think of you. Does that sound good? Yes, but what did we prove by showing how strong the clip was? Hey, we just proved the function, that it wouldn't fall off and get lost. We didn't prove the benefit, which was increased sales, because they see the name and imprinted website address more times. That's what you need to prove and nail down. See, isn't this fun, tearing apart somebody else's sales presentation? You know, I've been out on sales calls with hundreds of different salespeople in my career, and it's just amazing how few of them sell benefits and then prove them with evidence, and then get their prospect to admit that they believe it. So back to that little pen with what may be 10 parts to it, including the color and the lettering and the style of the imprint. I mean, if you miss something as simple as that with the clip, what can happen on a high-tech product with lots of bells and whistles or a complicated piece of equipment? You can prove to the purchasing agent the benefit of increased sales by showing research studies on how often people use a pen. And just for your information, the average person uses 487 pens in their lifetime. And how unconsciously their message gets into their customer's thinking by just holding that pen. Lots of ways to go for evidence once you know what it is you want to prove. So in each of these examples, it's important for you to see that regardless of the selling situation, the concept of selling the benefits using units of conviction will work. Remember your assignment. Listen to my specifics, determine the principles they illustrate, and then create your own specifics. And then ask yourself, how can I improve on that idea? How can I make it even better? And by the way, how much evidence do you need? Well, as they say in legal terms, just enough to get beyond a reasonable doubt. I mean, you won't prove to everybody what you say is true. I mean, some people won't believe anything a salesperson says. But most people will accept what you say if your evidence is believable. Now, caution, watch out for some of those phrases the ordinary salesperson uses. Oh, man, this is unbelievable. It's so good. Or, you know, this is unbelievable. Okay, you're right, I don't believe you. Hey, what did you just say? It was unbelievable. So work on being believable. If you were to stop this message right now and think back to your last visit with your last prospect, how would you rate your selling of benefits? How well did you answer their cries of, so what? Who cares? And prove it. Did you prove it? Well, hopefully you did. And if not, you'll be more conscious of it the next time you see them. Now, just supposing you stopped this message and went right back to the beginning of the last statement you heard. You would have heard me say, 6 yous, 4 yours, and 1 you'll. Not one I, me, mine, or ours. And that's your next idea of selling the benefits. It's called the you factor, using you and not I's. The ordinary salesperson uses I's almost all the time. Just listen when you're the prospect. You hear things like this. Yes, I really love the new colors we have in our new models of sports cars. Or, yes, sir, I like how this tie looks with that suit. And I also like this shirt to go with it. Or shoes. Oh, I just love a good-looking shoe on a lady's foot. To me, it just makes the entire outfit. Hey, I, me. If you recorded your last sales presentation that you made, how many you words would you have versus the I words? You know, this is an idea when he heard it that got Jim Hayes at Mastercraft Boats to begin consciously evaluating what he was saying to his boat prospects. He used to say things like this, I love the fuel injection engines. When I hop in my Mastercraft boat, all I do is turn on the key and it starts like my car. Well, good, Jim. Then you buy this boat if you love it so much. Now, of course, if you met Jim and Debbie Hayes now, what you'd really hear is more like this. You'll love having a fuel injection engine in your new Mastercraft. And when you hop in, all you do is turn your key and it'll start just like your car. That's 3 U's, 3 yours, and 1 you'll. 7 U-focused words and not a single I-focused word. How about pulling out that last letter or a fax or an email you sent to one of your customers or prospects? Count your I's versus U's and begin now adding even more you and your and you'll to your selling presentations. Estimates vary based on slang words, industry-specific words, and regional usage. But one study I read said that there are approximately 450,000 words in the English language. And get this, 80% of most people's communication is made with only 4,000 of those words. And in the top 10 most used words is I. Add to that the use of me and my and mine and we and ours, and you have the exact opposite of the you-focused selling that we're talking about here. You may remember back at the beginning of message number 5 with our elephant salesman. He used 3 units of conviction in his presentation. Next time you listen to that message, notice the first one. He said, referring to the elephant, he's specially trained to do heavy farm work. It would save you a lot of time. Watch what he can do. And then he demonstrated. Then he pointed out that the elephant could do the work of 9 horses. He nailed that down by asking, that's amazing, isn't it? And the farmer responded, yes, it sure is. His trunk works like a giant hand. Do you think the farmer believed him? Well, sure he did. He had seen the evidence. How about the benefit? How did our elephant sales professional know what benefit to show? Well, he only knew because he had qualified effectively. You see, that's why it's so vital to use that qualifying step. How can you show the benefits if you don't know what the prospect needs? So often we hear salespeople stringing together a series of product facts and functions, but hardly ever relating any of them to the needs of their prospects. And you know why they don't? They hardly ever bother to find out what those needs are. Now, how do you prove these benefits? Well, there are a number of different forms of evidence. Some are more appropriate than others, depending on your prospect and your product. You can use facts and statistics, showing something in print from a reliable third-party source. Now, many salespeople use these in scientific sales situations, as well as medical, engineering, and communication systems. You could say something like, here's a report from NASA on the impact of global warming. And then you show it or selected portions of that report. Here's the FDA and AMA's research on the recently launched new drug. Oh, I just couldn't resist throwing in those acronyms. Now, of course, a pharmaceutical sales rep speaking to her physician prospects certainly could use those acronyms, the FDA for the Federal Drug Administration and the AMA for the American Medical Association, without any concern that they wouldn't understand what those acronyms meant. But just watch out for your own internal buzzwords slipping out at the wrong time. So what types of statistics by a third party can you use to help you prove the benefit? The more you use, the higher degree of believability and trust you'll earn from your prospect. Your evidence could be on a chart, a graph, a map, a brochure, a newspaper, a magazine article, an independent study by a university, or a government survey result. The next form of evidence is a demonstration. Here's where you actually put your product into action. You demonstrate it. The elephant using its trunk like a hand to pick up a tiny and delicate egg. The boat pulling a giant-sized water skier out of the water effortlessly. The pen staying clipped to a notebook. One salesperson for a major glass manufacturer told me how she demonstrated safety glass that was shatterproof. This was when it was first invented years ago, and only a few buyers had ever seen it before. This great sales professional, a member of the top 1% club, told her prospects all the features and sold the benefits of having shatterproof glass in their products that wouldn't just break apart and cut people. So when she got to the evidence step, prove it, she took out a 4-inch by 4-inch square piece of glass and a hammer and whacked it right in front of a prospect, right on their desk. Well, the prospect covered his eyes by reflex and then stared in amazement at the broken, but still in one-piece sample. Lots of sales were made, and she was named Salesperson of the Year for outselling everyone and for creating that unique demonstration as a form of evidence. Now, the next year, all salespeople in the company got 4-inch by 4-inch samples and a hammer. But again, she was number one. When she was asked at the national sales meeting how she outsold everybody again, even though they all had the same form of demonstration, this time I gave my prospect the hammer and let them hit the glass. It's even more impacting that way. Wow! How can you get your prospects into your presentation? What can you do to have them ride the elephant, drive the boat, clip the pen on something, or hit the piece of glass? Plan on getting your prospects into your sales presentations. Now, sure, there's a risk. They might not do the right things in the right way. Your job is to minimize the risk. So prepare, prepare, prepare. It's all in your foundation work. Now, the next form of evidence is to use an exhibit. This is like a demonstration, except there's no action. This could be a display or an actual sample. It could be a cutaway. Some manufacturers actually saw their products in half to show you what it looks like on the inside or how it works. Go to one of those giant warehouse clubs and the food section is filled with samples of new food items for you to taste. You pop it in your mouth, you like how it tastes, you buy the product. End of sales presentation. Or just look on the internet and the shopping services. They'll show you an exhibit of what's for sale. Now you might be saying, no, wait a minute, Weldon. I can't demonstrate or exhibit what I sell. I mean, I sell a service. I sell an intangible. I sell ideas. No way can my prospects see or touch what I sell. Yes, it's true. Lots of intangibles are sold. And if that's what you sell, your challenge is to figure out a way to still use evidence to prove your benefits. You can use evidence in the form of testimonials. And this is so powerful because no matter what you're selling, you can get a testimonial. It's amazing how few people use these. A testimonial can be a letter or a note from a satisfied customer. It might be a newspaper article, or an expert's opinion of your product. One creative salesperson I knew kept an autograph book full of customer comments, and after each sale, she had the customer write something. Then on a service call, after the customer had used the product, she asked for another written comment. The first comment was about the salesperson. The second comment was about the product. Can you imagine what a powerful form of evidence that little autograph book became as it filled up? One of the most impacting forms of evidence can be your testimonial letters from thrilled clients or customers. So use them. Put them in a giant binder. Bring them along on a sales call and say, as you open up a book of 500 letters, just open them anywhere and read what my customers say about me and the benefits they've received. You'll be as thrilled as they were. So go ahead, just pick one. How good is your collection of evidence? Would it stand up in court? Another type of evidence is an analogy. What type of analogies can you use to make the benefits even more believable? One of America's best-known communicators was President Ronald Reagan. If you could go back in time and listen to his presidential speeches and his State of the Union addresses, you'd hear what this master of analogies would say. Things like, you know, it's just like so-and-so sitting up there in the balcony next to my Nancy. You see, they had it tough too. So here's what they did. And then he'd tell a story. You know that old truism, one picture is worth a thousand words? Well, my listening friend, one story is worth a thousand pictures. So be sure to use stories as part of the evidence step in your units of conviction. Now, the final part of a unit of conviction is the nail down. Once you've provided evidence, you need to check to see if your prospect accepts it and agrees with it. So in order to get a nail down, you ask a closed question, and in most cases, end that question with, isn't it? Don't you? Wouldn't they? Wouldn't you? Right? Okay? You know, I love listening to Canadian salespeople sell because they have a built-in nail down. They often end their sentences with A. They say things like, that's a pretty good idea, eh? And each time they do, you respond. Draw your prospects into your presentation as much as possible. Ask if they're agreeing with you so far. That makes sense, doesn't it? Whoops, there's a nail down. It's just automatic, isn't it? So from this moment on, whenever you state a fact or a feature, ask yourself, so what and who cares? That question will force you to quickly translate the fact or feature into a benefit. And then as you state the benefit, hear the statement in your mind. Prove it. Prove it, please. This will force you to quickly offer some evidence. Now here's a story you can certainly relate to. It concerns shopping for clothes. Now you've done that, right? Love it or hate it, you've done it dozens or hundreds of times and met lots of retail store clerks. But most likely not like the young man who helped me invest in some shirts. Here's the story. Now remember, this is my story. It's true, but it's also an analogy for you. The problem. All good stories have to have a problem. And in this story, it's me. It's my body. You see, I have a skinny neck and long arms and wear a 15-35 dress shirt. Now, that might not seem like much of a problem until you attempt to buy one. You see, skinny necks usually go with smaller men and therefore shorter arms and sleeves. So 15-inch necks most likely go with 32 or 33-inch sleeves. And my 35-inch long arms usually go with big 16, 17, 18-inch thick necks, not 15. So that's my dilemma. And years ago here in Scottsdale, when this happened, no men's store carried any really nice 15-35 shirts. Oh, sure, I could get them special ordered, or I'd get them custom made, which I did, but it took time, effort, and energy, and I just didn't like to bother. Okay, now the specifics. East Coast, big city, doing a seminar, check in the hotel, look at my shirt for the next day's seminar, and it's just not that good. It's kind of worn. It's okay, but it's not perfect. So since it's early and my clients won't be arriving till after dinner to go over the room setup, I had some extra time. So I went to the hotel lobby's men's shop, figuring in this big city, someone else has to wear a 15-35 shirt. Looking around the store, there's no one there. So I say, hello, hello. And this voice comes back from the back, yeah, what do you want? Well, I think I got a problem. And before I could finish the statement, problem with my shirts, he shouts out, hey, buddy, I got enough of my own problem. Talk about a poor first impression. And so out I went. Hey, there were men's stores on almost every corner. I saw them when the taxi driver brought me in that afternoon. No, it wasn't Willie. This guy charged me $30 in a dirty, smelly car, and of course he never even thought of asking me if I needed a ride back to the airport. I sure needed Willie that day. Okay, well, back to the shirt story. So I left the hotel, I walked the block, found another men's store, I stepped inside. It was empty. I looked around, nobody's there, and I said, Hello? Hello? And again, a voice comes back from the back. Yeah, what do you want? I thought, were these two guys trained by the same store manager? Well, I quickly responded, I think I need a shirt. And yelling from the back, do you or don't you, he says. Wow, what selling. What a city, what a bummer. So out I went. One more block, another men's store. Now this time, you come with me. Come on, you be my helper. So we go in, the store's empty, and I'm prepared this time. And I'm just about to say something when a nicely dressed young man pops from behind the suit rack, smiling ear to ear, walks right towards me, hands extended out in a greeting position, like I'm an old friend. And he says, hi, how may I help you? Now that's an improvement, I thought. So I quickly said, I got a problem with my shirts. He responds, smiling, then you came to the right place. We specialize in solving clothing problems. What exactly is your problem? Now, while saying that, he reaches for a spiral notepad on the counter and a pen, and he's poised to write. I say, I wear a 1535 shirt size. I'm from Scottsdale, Arizona. I can't find them there. Do you have any? Writing on his pad, 1535 Scottsdale, Arizona, he looks up and says, what's your name, sir? I said, Joel Weldon. He writes it down. Then he says, well, Mr. Weldon, that's a very unusual size shirt. But you sure did come to the right place today, because I have a wonderful selection of fine men's shirts in your 1535 size. But before I show you your shirts, may I ask you a few other questions? Well, I said, sure, what do you want to know? Pad still in hand, he says, what exactly is the problem you spoke of with the shirts you now have? Well, I said, they always wear out, since I can't replace them easily. Well, he says, wear out where? And I say, my cuffs, especially the left one, where my watch rubs the cuff and wears it out. He writes below Scottsdale, Arizona, 1535, cuffs wearing out. Well, then I said, the collars wear out too. I have a heavy beard and it frays my collar when I wear a tie. He writes that down, collar wears out. Now, for a moment, I thought that this shirt sales pro had known my friend Lou Wright, because looking at his pad, then looking at me, he says, is there anything else? Well, yes, I said, my buttons. I'm a button freak. And with that, he backs up a little bit and says, well, what do you mean? Oh, I hate losing buttons off my shirt. I'm getting dressed for a meeting. One falls off, or it gets broken or cracked when it's laundered and pressed. So I got to go find another button and sew it on. I got you, Mr. Weldon. He writes that all down, broken buttons. I think you'll agree, this guy is good. So now he pauses, looks at his little pad, reflecting for a moment, and then says, just supposing, Mr. Weldon, that I could solve all your shirt problems, the right fit, your cuff and collars won't wear out, your buttons won't fall off, pull off, or crack, would you be willing to invest in more than one or two shirts to take back to Arizona with you? Oh, sure, I said, almost foaming at the mouth with anticipation. I mean, no more shirt problems? So he says, come in the back, and turns and walks to the back of a store in the back room area. I follow him. You follow me. He stops, pulls out a box off the top shelf that's marked 1535. I can't wait. He pops it open. 12 1535 shirts. Never saw that many in one place at one time. He goes over to a counter in the back, and I notice some construction is going on in the corner. So on a clean counter, he opens up the box and fans, like a deck of cards, the 12 1535 shirts in several different colors, mostly white, and then says, Mr. Weldon, pick one out and try it on in the dressing room, which was in the back. So I do. It fits perfectly. He then picks up his little pad and pen, stands next to me as we look in the mirror and says, how does it fit? Well, great. It's perfect. He then checks off 1535 on his list of my four problems. Then he says, watch this, Mr. Weldon. He picks up a short piece of 2x4 material. It was on the floor, and quickly and roughly rubs it on the cuff and the collar. Not on the shirt I'm wearing. One of the others that was on the counter. And then he says, your cuffs and your collar will never wear out. I said, wow, how did you do that? Oh, he says, I didn't. Your shirt manufacturer did. You see, they use a new high-tech synthetic fiber on the two highest wear areas on fine men's shirts, your cuffs and your collar. Are you noticing how he's using you and your all the time? He's got to be a top 1% club member. So I say, well, that's amazing. What about my buttons? And he says, watch this. He picks up a hammer from the construction project and hits the center button on the shirt. No, not the one I'm wearing. One that's on the counter. And then he holds it up and says, it's not broken and it won't break. I'm amazed. Now, how did you do that? I said. Oh, he says, I didn't do it. Your shirt manufacturer did. You see, it's an epoxy-based, mother-of-pearl-covered, sewn-on with silk thread button. It won't pull off a crack. That would save you lots of wasted sewing time, wouldn't it, Mr. Weldon? Oh, sure would, I said, amazed, delighted, and thrilled with the shirt. Then he turns to me with a smile, the same smile I've seen from Willie Cooley, Jim Hayes, and Mr. Richards, and says, "How many do you want, Mr. Weldon?" "All of them," I said. "Hey, what would you have said if you had my shirt problems?" "But what about the price? What's the price?" "Who cares? When you solve the customer's problem, price is rarely an issue, right? And the bigger the problem to solve, the less price is an issue. Hey, I couldn't find 12, 15, 35 shirts in the whole state of Arizona, no less in one store. So you guessed it, I bought all of them, and I still have some of them. And if you see me at a seminar, come check them out." You might wonder, how do I remember these stories? I mean, the exact words. I mean, what Willie said, Jim Hayes, and Mr. Richards, and Martin Howie, and Doug Baker, and the shirt guy. I remember them for several reasons. They happened to me. I mean, I lived them. I saw them firsthand, and they're vivid pictures in my mind. I wrote them down, word for word, right after they happened to me. Because I was taught by my sales manager, Vernon Cavill, my first year in sales, to learn to sell by watching those who sell you and pay close attention to the little things. Plus, it's my business. My job is to look for specifics that illustrate timeless principles and share them with my clients in my seminars and with you on these messages. So what does that 1535 shirt story illustrate for you? Well, I wrote down a whole list of principles, and here, let me read them to you. Number one, customer problems are great sales opportunities. Number two, the more difficult the customer's problem, the bigger the sale can be. Number three, finding the problem and the need is the key to the sale. Number four, one caring professional can make the difference. Number five, it's not just having the right product. Stores one and two might have carried those same 1535 shirts. It's getting in front of the customer and selling it. That's what really counts. Number six, you don't need totally unique products or services. You just have to fit the product you have to the customer's needs. And the seventh principle, price usually isn't the issue. It's usually, will your product solve my problem and meet my needs? In addition to those seven principles, I think what also impacted me so much was the young salesman's selling skills and his overall positive and helpful attitude. And how he impressed me after those two negative experiences, saying, "How may I help you?" Not, "Can I help you?" Which is too common, and it's a closed question. And really, what "can I help you" means maybe I will or maybe I won't, depends on my mood right now. How he probed for my four needs, and then how he wrote them down. Big point here. Write down your prospect's problems, wants, and needs right in front of them. It shows that you're interested and focused on them. Plus, it shows your intention to do something about them. How about his great trial close? And we'll discuss that soon in depth in messages 7 and 8. He said, "If I could solve all four of your shirt problems, would you be willing to invest in more than one or two shirts and take them back to Arizona with you?" Great trial close to check for a sign of interest. Then his demonstration. Now, he didn't use our units of conviction like we discussed, but he accomplished the job with his dramatic display of showmanship with the 2x4 and the hammer. And, of course, he knew how to close. How many do you want? Wow. So let's get some specific things going here, some action steps for you. Again, I wrote them down. Number one, make a list of at least three of your most important product or service features or facts. Number two, write out a word-for-word unit of conviction for each of the three. I mean, cover all the steps we talked about them. Fact or feature, the answer, so what? Then the function of that fact or feature, the answer, who cares? The benefit of that function to the product, to the customer, to the end user. And then the evidence to prove it. I mean, how can you prove the benefit? Then you nail it down and get verbal agreement. Number three, then test them on other salespeople that you work with, your sales manager, spouse, friends, and then on your prospects. See, you want to fine-tune them to your style and situation, not necessarily memorizing word for word, but covering the steps with positive, impacting words and actions. Idea number four, record an actual sales presentation and listen to how you speak. Count your I's and your U's. Count your facts and features and your benefits. Listen for the nail downs. I record almost every seminar or keynote I give. It sure helps you improve, and it lets you know as a speaker, or you as a salesperson, which one of the three presentations you give. And there are three possibilities: the one you plan to give, the one you actually gave, and the one you should have given. Record yourself, and you don't have to let anybody else hear it. It's just for you. Now, idea number five. Make sure you sell all your features and benefits that apply to your prospect situation. All of them. Here's an old story that makes a great point in this high-tech world that we live in. A little old man, hey, now that's a variation from a little old lady that we told earlier, went into a large appliance store to buy a refrigerator. He hadn't bought one in over 40 years since his wife, who had just died, took care of all their appliance purchases. Now he was faced with a decision. So he did what so many potential buyers do. He narrowed it down to a couple of brands and two specific models. The old man, now armed with this basic information about cubic footage and energy efficiency, went into the store to take a look firsthand and kick a couple of refrigerator doors, being from the old school. Well, the salesperson, again, did a pretty good job of selling the features and a fair job on the benefits, but the old man, the buying prospect, insisted on shopping another store and comparing their value. And since he had called that store and they were very nice to him on the phone, he felt an obligation. By the way, how nice are your support people on the phone to your prospects who call in, checking on products or features or price or availability? It can often mean the difference between an appointment or no appointment. So the old man checks out store number two and ends up buying the exact same refrigerator he was shown in store number one. After the transaction was complete, he goes back to store number one to say thank you to the salesperson who waited on him and inform him of his purchase at the competitor's store, which he does. Remember, the prospect was a little old man from the old school. Most of your prospects probably don't have the time or the inclination to come back to you and tell you that they bought something else. Well, the salesperson was gracious in defeat and most appreciative that the prospect had the courtesy to tell him that he had ended up buying something else. Almost as an afterthought, the salesperson who lost the sale asked, well, which model did you buy? Shocked when he hears the answer, he says, that's the exact same one I showed you. How much was it? The old man tells him, and even more shocked, the salesperson says, that's $25 more. Oh, the old man says, it couldn't be the same one, because the one I got has a little light inside that goes on when the door is open. Now, shaking his head in disbelief, the salesperson says, but sir, all refrigerators have those lights. The little old man looks at the salesperson somewhat confused and says, really? Why didn't you tell me yours had that? Aha! That's such a powerful selling lesson. Don't assume. Make sure your prospect knows all the important features and their benefits. How much of what you sell is so commonplace, so basic, so ordinary that you forget to even mention it? So how could store number one salesperson have done it? Qualified better? How old is your present refrigerator? When did you last look at refrigerators? Hey, if it was 40 years ago and the bulb had been burned out, he'd never know it was standard. So don't assume. Technology has made such amazing advances in so many products, and yet one downside of this amazing technological revolution that you've lived through is that it's leveled the playing field. So many products today are just thought of as commodities. Now the difference in performance isn't based on some innovative design or some secret ingredient or even price. It's usually based on marketing and selling ability. Take your watch. Look at it. I mean, just look at it. It could be a basic digital sports watch that has an alarm, date, stopwatch, lap times, and a mini computer to store data. And it could sell for the price of a dinner for two at an average price restaurant. Or it could be a well-crafted timepiece with the date and a self-winding feature and cost as much as a luxury car. If the goal is to just know the time, actually both have equal technology. The price differential is for other features. Solid gold versus black plastic. Diamonds versus a plastic strap. And so on. But both might keep nearly perfect time. So you need to be sure that you sell all your product's unique features and benefits. In the world of specification writing, the designer, architect, engineer, or buyer uses the term or equal when describing a manufacturer's product. Does that mean that competitors' products are equal to yours? Well, most likely not. But keep in mind, it's not what is, it's what your prospect thinks is. That's what counts. And what is real and true is important. But so is what your prospect perceives to be real and true. Because it's what they perceive things to be that determines their actions. Perception defines reality. Go back 600 years and you'll see how true that perception is reality. When all wise and knowledgeable people knew the earth was flat and that ship's captains going too far out to sea would fall off the edge of the earth, so wise captains kept their ships fairly close to land. The world of business is the same. False or incorrect views prevent positive action. And finally, focus on benefits. Benefits, benefits, and benefits. And the next time you hear this sound, you'll know that most likely what the customer really wanted was not the drill, but the benefits, the holes it could drill. Here's the sound of selling the benefits.